Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunked. We have one of our former special guests on today, Jonathan Logan. He was with us for the excellent show on What is Hawala. Jonathan is a respected crypto anarchist working in black IT and author of the underground smash hit book, The Second Realm, a book on strategy. And if any of the listeners out there have not read this book, run, don't walk, and get it. You can find it at secondrealm.net. Jonathan, are you there?
I'm here. Hello.
Hey, I don't know if I got that URL right. Was that the Second Realm or no? It's just secondrealm.net, correct?
Just secondrealm.net.
Yeah, you can download the PDF there, and it is a fantastic book, talking on cypherpunk agorism and stuff in meat space and online and just whole strategy. It's not just something that talks about philosophy, and it's not something that just talks about the mechanics of crypto or anything. It's actually an overall strategy for Second Realm stuff. So I highly recommend that. And today we're going to talk specifically about something that is mentioned in this book, The Second Realm, and it's called TAZ, T-A-Z, Temporary Autonomous Zones. And I'm not going to give an intro into this. I'm just going to let Jonathan start off on this. Go ahead, Jonathan. Why don't you tell us something about what is this TAZ?
Okay. TAZ, Temporary Autonomous Zone, those are spaces or places where we actually have enough control that the state, for example, is marginalized. So there could be a festival or something where lots of people, like-minded people, are having fun together, and they have so much fun that the police simply cannot yield any power there. For example, Burning Man a few years ago was that kind of a place where the state really didn't matter. Other examples are street markets often. So you have those unregulated street markets where people, you know, just trade by their own rules, and the state is not much more than an observer. So it's a place where the inhabitants are the ones that actually have the factual control.
Great. Now, those type of systems right now, and we'll probably get into some more specific examples, some of that are mentioned in the book, but you take this in the book, you talk about doing this in meat space, and you talk about in cyberspace also.
Yes, absolutely. And the basic concept of marginalizing third-party intervention is something that you can have both in the physical and in the digital. It's pretty easy to do it in the digital. I mean, most people know and use digital autonomous zones all the time. For example, those of you that use the Tor hidden services or the I2P network or that are on agora.anaplex or stuff like that. Those are places where the state really doesn't matter that much. So digital autonomous zones are something most of us use and know and most of us love. Physical temporary autonomous zones are a little bit harder, especially if you don't want them just for a few hours, but for rather for several months or something. But still, there are some examples of that. And the reason why I think that both the digital and the physical autonomous zones are important is that people, humans, are actually physical beings. I mean, we most of us don't live online. We have friends that are physical, that we meet in the physical, we share a beer, we talk face to face, we trade physical goods, most of our food is physical. So we need both actually to have some autonomy.
Okay, great. Let's go give and talk about one example that most people are not aware of, these TAS environments. Many are familiar with the Burning Man and some of the other groupings together that can come about, but a lot of people don't realize that there are actually these TAS that are not temporary. They're permanent, and they've been that way for a long time. And why don't we start with South America with the favelas and talk about what actually goes on here and how these places actually are in a way sovereign entities of themselves, even though they're within countries that may not be known for allowing any type of free, you know, they're not known for liberty or freedom or giving people their space. You want to start with
right.
The favela?
Sure. Favelas are, as everyone knows, something that is often represented as slum and chaos and everything like that in the media. However, favelas are much more than that, and often they have very little to do with chaos. Essentially, favelas are unofficial or informal settlements. They have been erected by their inhabitants without getting a license. And they're often cut off from any kind of infrastructure and state service. And they also, in their whole existence, a kind of a defiance of the control of the state, which has led over several years now to favelas becoming something like no-go areas for the police. And instead of just, you know, dropping into chaos, many favelas have created their own internal systems of social cooperation. So what you will find often is providers of infrastructure. So you have people that sell water or actually put in water pipes and sell water. The same is true for power. So there will be specialized people that tap into power supplies somewhere, most of the time illegally, and then connect the inhabitants to electric power. But what you also will find are internal rules of who owns what. And those rules are even enforced, both by the community and often by internal providers of security.
Okay.
And what we find currently is that in many favelas, the former drug lords are turning into becoming something like government service providers. So essentially, you can subscribe to one of those drug gangs, not for drugs, but for keeping peace.
Okay.
And that is one of the emerging business models in the favelas in parts of Brazil right now.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask. This is in some of the these are located, usually, aren't they located in the fringe or specific areas of some of the larger cities?
Yes, usually those are parts of cities. Most of the time, those are areas within the city that once were outside of the city or at the city border and then became squatted, and often the city grows around them.
Okay.
So it's part of the city by now.
Now, you mentioned the providers of security. So you have a system where you have these little cities, these little zones inside of some major cities in the major countries, and the police don't go into these areas. So you said, like you said, you think, oh, there's chaos. So in these things, are if the police don't go in there, there's not rampant theft and rape and murder going on all over the place?
Of course there is rape and murder and theft going on, as it does in every area, specifically in areas where the police actually is or pretends to be. But it's not as unruly as one would imagine. It's more ruly than in the official areas where corruption is much more prevalent. So it's we shouldn't think of those places as being heaven on earth,
right.
But they are not places of pure chaos. People actually have the tendency, if they're left to their own devices, to find out ways to live peacefully with each other, and this is what happens in favelas.
Right. You know, let's go back over to. Let's talk about some of the ghettos. So let's slide over there. I think some of the Jewish ghettos, they have some examples also of these Taz zones, correct?
Right. Today, no Jewish ghettos exist anymore, or ghettos in itself in their original meaning. But ghettos started in Venice in the late part of the Renaissance when... basically, the city government said, okay, we want certain people and certain professions to not part of the main city, but they were moved to other places. And in Venice, these were specific islands, so Venice is a city that is built on islands and in between. And one of the first ghettos was a Jewish ghetto, where basically Jews in several professions went, and they had their own internal regulations. So the state or the city was not so much concerned about what they did internally. They had their own tax code. They had their own regulations on how to deal with each other. So the only thing the city was concerned with is when the ghetto touched the rest of the city,
right.
So at the borders, so to speak. And this has been true for most ghettos over the centuries, essentially.
Well, you know, it seems like many people today, they would, in some ways, like, you know, welcome that. I mean, right now, it's like they nobody will leave anybody alone. And it's gotten to the point where, what, you're going to let us have this little area where, you know, we can have our own justice system. We can have our own community. You know, we can do all this stuff on our own. And you're really not going to come in here and mess with it all. You know, not that those situations were ideal, but it's just kind of humorous that those powers back then would actually say, "You guys just do whatever you want. You just stay away from us." And
right.
And many of us would kind of welcome a lot of that today.
Right. It wasn't so much about, you know, the government realizing that other people should be freer. You know, they wanted some people to be not part of their system.
Right.
So it was part of an ostracism system.
Uh-huh.
And essentially, the ostracized people, the outlaws, made their own laws. And the cities back then were little concerned about what was really going on in the ghettos, because those were places where no good citizen went, usually.
Right. Yeah.
So why care about them? So that was more or less the strategy. It was a part of something mixed up out of discrimination and efficiency. And... today, I think ghettos only are looked at from the discrimination point. But ghettos served a lot to preserve cultures that might have disappeared without them. So, for example, the Jewish diaspora, while they didn't enjoy the ghettos helped them to preserve their culture. So it's not... It wasn't the best thing on the planet, but it wasn't the worst thing ever either. Right. So it's a two-edged sword there.
Yeah, can you explain what you mean by the term the diaspora?
The diaspora is the time where the so-called people of Israel, after they were expelled from Palestine by the Romans, settled in other countries and basically intermingled with the people. But the intermingling didn't destroy their culture. They were still able to preserve most of their culture. And then after the Second World War, large parts of them went back to Palestine and forming the state of Israel today. So the time between being kicked out by the Romans in whatever, I think 90-something after Christ, till 1940-something. That's the time that's called diaspora.
Right. Okay. So then, in these examples of the Jewish Taz zones,
it was
based upon an ostracism, an exclusionary type thing of racism or cultural ism or, you know, whatever, okay? Now, down in South America, when you're talking about the Brazilian, it's more of a, what I guess some people would call economic disenfranchised or people of that did not fit into the city structure, or if they did, they fit in as maids and taxi drivers or something like that, but they weren't big taxpayers with apartments and houses and property and all of this. And maybe many of them were immigrants from other parts of the country seeking out better economic opportunities, and then they wind up in these areas of lower income activity. And then as that grows, you start to have these needs and economic and social and trading type and market type structure starting to develop because of the fact that so many people are located in this area. So
right.
Now, do you have other examples that you are aware of in other parts of the world, like Africa or Asia or even
sure.
North America?
Yeah, sure. In Africa, we have the same thing. We have what we call slums today. So it's pretty usual and often seen that poorer people break out of the limitations of society by creating their own societies and helping each other to survive. So slums for a certain part, they're not nice, of course, but they develop internal systems of cooperation, and they develop internal markets, and they actually slip out of control from the central government. So that is all over Africa. In other parts of the world, maybe one example that I really personally love totally is parts of South Africa, in Argentina and I think in Nicaragua, there are skyscrapers that have been squatted. So basically you have the whole 20-story skyscraper, and it's basically a vertical city where people
really
live in and built their own society, and no government official went in there for years, because it's actually dangerous to get in there when you're a policeman. You usually have a low rate of survival if you do it. But it's a fun thing to think about, a vertical city that is more or less independent. And vertical infrastructure and architecture is really hard to raid again, or to get in there and take over control again, because the access is very limited to the ground floors.
Right.
Other big examples, one that is possibly the thing that inspired me most is Kowloon City, which has been a place in Hong Kong. It was actually on the border between British Hong Kong and China. and very near to the airport. And the British and the Chinese, they, you know, both didn't know what to do with it, and no one really wanted to take part of the place. And it was essentially an apartment building, or pretty big apartment building. And what happened is that people went in there, especially people that fled from China, and they got in there and built their own society. And that society.
This started in what year? Can you trace this back to in history?
Somewhere in the 50s.
Okay. Now, when you say it's an apartment building, I've seen photos of this thing before it was torn down, and it was stunning. It was an apartment building back then, and then it kind of like just grew out from there.
Absolutely. It was several blocks of apartments, and with all the people moving in and making changes to it, essentially what happened is that all free space was used. So when you look at later pictures of that place, it looks like a single solid block of organic life.
Yeah.
That's all you see, you know, and it looks awesome. And it's actually a pretty famous spot. For example, movies like Johnny Mnemonic, or I think even Blade Runner, they had parts of the movie shot there.
Okay.
So it's kind of, you know, famous. However, it's not there anymore. I mean, the place has been torn down in the 90s, and there's a park now, which is really boring. But Kowloon housed something like 30,000 people.
Yeah, 30,000.
No one really knows for sure, but it was the highest density housing on the planet. And people did almost everything there. So you had miniature manufacturing places, like having a small company on 12 to 15 square meters producing food, or producing tires, or producing whatever.
Yeah.
You had a lot of dentists in there, which is one of the curious thing about it, because essentially it was very hard to get a dental shop open in Hong Kong. So if you couldn't spend the money for the license, you would become an underground dentist in Kowloon.
Wow.
You had nightclubs there. You had opium held there. You had everything there. Mm-hmm. And people not only worked there, but also lived there. So it was an integrated environment. And it was a kind of messy place. I mean, it's not Western standard clean stuff there. But it's an example for a long-living autonomous zone where police wouldn't do anything there. The only thing that provided some rule of law there is actually that the triads made sure that the place didn't go out of control.
Okay, explain this triads.
The triads are something that we would call organized crime today.
Uh-huh.
And it's the Hong Kong Mafia, more or less. And they had lots of business going on there, and they wanted to make sure that they would not be harmed by outsiders.
Right.
So they made sure that not too much crime was happening there, or not too much overt crime was happening there, so that the police wouldn't be attracted to the place.
Right.
And the other thing that they did a lot is that triad members that were growing old spent their pension years there. So essentially they received rooms from the triads where they sat all day and talked with the neighbors and drank and smoked. And so it was something like a retirement home for the triads as well.
Wow, that's quite fascinating. You know, to talk about this border, you know, in the building example, the tall skyscraper buildings, and now the Kowloon City, there's this, the border, okay? And that may be these, you know, the entrance gate where you walk in, and the front door where the elevators go up, and normally there's your valet guy there or something in New York City. So, you know, just because you have a building like that doesn't mean that you're this, you know, sovereign country. You have to, like you brought up, they got to make sure that nothing's happening, that's too much of a problem. Like if you had one of these skyscrapers and you were part of you were the owner of it, or you were one of the chieftains, or the main one of the main providers of security for the building, and you had your interest and the like. These, you know, someone goes out and robs one of the national banks, and then they make a beeline right to your building and go up inside of it. You got big problems with the local city, state, or feds. So you're not going to let that kind of stuff go on.
Absolutely. I mean, the term sovereign country doesn't apply to that place anyways. So the temporary autonomous zones or autonomous zones are places where the state is marginalized. So the whole state is marginalized. It doesn't project its force all the time to that place. But to keep it that way, you have to play politics a little bit to the outsiders. You may not be the biggest nuisance around. You shouldn't be the source of snipers on the roof shooting pedestrians over in your host country. You shouldn't be the place where children are trafficked or whatever. So what you have is you need to create a relationship with the outsiders, where the outsiders say, I wouldn't want to live there, but I don't care what they do because it doesn't affect me.
Right. Right.
So that is basically what you have to do. And in that moment, the police has a harder time to justify, batting you down. So that is one of the big things. The other thing is that even if you're, a little bit unruly there and you break certain outside laws, the police might still not be interested to bother with you as long as you're not affecting too many people outside of the zone. Because raiding an autonomous zone like Kowloon or like one of those skyscrapers, it's dangerous. It's dangerous and it's costly. So they don't do it for minor offenses. They don't care if, someone is smoking pot there or selling pot there. They don't care.
Right.
Because it wouldn't justify the costs and the risks to raid the place. So they leave it alone. And there are a few examples how far this can go. For example, in Europe, in Denmark, there's a place called Christiania. And it's a former military compound. And it was squatted, I think, in the 60s or 70s. And essentially people built a very, grassroots kind of society there.
Right,
uh-huh. And they sold pot, marijuana, like kilos of it. Mm-hmm. And they actually had street dealers with stands that would sell drugs. And the police, after a while, gave up enforcing the law there because, it didn't change much. And it was more or less becoming a tourist attraction. So it became a source of income for the state that tourists would come and visit that place and have a joint there. So that is what can happen. And
sort of a symbiotic relationship starts to develop in some of these.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Now, yes. And the Christian, in the, what did you call it, Christiania?
Christiania, yeah. Yes.
I think I remember hearing something even recently within the past few months where the government was looking at selling off some of the property.
Absolutely.
And the people were kind of up in arms about it. And I thought it was interesting that all these people are living here, but they're actually on government property. And and there were some other things. I think like everyone living there, there's no deeds in their property, but they can pass off possession, but they can't sell it or something. It's an interesting system.
Yeah, I mean, Christiania is more or less a socialist kind of project. Mm-hmm. So it works by possession and whatever, and not by property title. And it shows another one of the big problems that many autonomous zones have, especially when it comes to squatted places, squatted buildings, is that they have a vector of attack and a vector of nuisance open that causes trouble, and that is that they don't own where they are.
Right.
So the original owners, be it the city or be it private owners, really don't like that. And sooner or later, that will boil up to conflict where force will be justified. And the other thing is that places like this, if they don't have a good internal property system, usually fall apart because parasites take the upper hand there. So most of those squatted places actually devour themselves. They destroy themselves. And the grade of people in there goes down if there's not an extra peace source there, a source of order and how to avoid conflict, like it was in Kowloon. In Kowloon, you had property rights. In many of those squatted skyscrapers, there are property rights.
Right.
So places like this tend to flourish, and they tend to become less and less of a problem. While people, while places that are just squatted and that have no internal coherence and no internal respect for property usually destroy themselves and become an invitation to destroy them from the outside.
Yeah, well,
so that is one of the big things one has to be careful about.
Were you talking about these TAZ zones, or are you talking about modern nation states here?
I think it's the same
principle. Yeah, that's something else. Let's go over to this one of the things I want to bring up is I know from some personal experience and things that I've seen that some of these areas are, when you talk about a relationship with the locals, many times that's not just increased tax income that they may have, but it can be with bribes. And bribes in many places can actually work very well. Because there's so much more to gain. And if they go and raid this place, then you're talking about maybe large numbers of police and families and public officials and the like. Actually, their standard of living dropping significantly. And you talked about the risks, and that's what I'm talking about now, of some of these people raiding them. What are some of the other things that would happen in these type of places with police coming in and deciding that they're going to go into this zone and cause problems? Like, I'll give an example. One issue that's happening, you hear quite a bit over the past few years, is this border between the United States and Mexico. And you have these little disputes where the U.S. is chasing some guy that's running into Mexico, and they'll be chasing him in somewhere outside of like San Diego near the border, where there'll be this big sewage ditch or something. And they'll chase him over and they'll shoot the guy, and the guy's body will be on the Mexican side of the border, and then they'll be trying to find out whether the agents actually crossed in. So you're talking jurisdictional issues here. So if you cross into that jurisdiction, it may not be a legal issue. You just may have a big problem as the police officer who did it with the powers that be that run this zone. You may have a problem with them personally. If you're a police captain who actually ordered it, then you may even have bigger problems if you already had some type of an agreement. So, when you talked about the consequences for going in there.
Right. It depends a little bit on how the system is set up. Personally, I'm not the biggest fan of working an autonomous zone on this high involvement level, where you bribe off people and very threaten people and whatever. So I'm not a big fan of that because I'm one of the guys that believe in peace and actually being a good neighbor and just not, you know, very interesting to target. I think there are other things to deter deter action against you. I mean, one of the things is, you know, reducing the motives for people to cause havoc. So, you know, don't be a nuisance. The other thing is there are strategies where you can actually survive a raid. You know, so you don't have to really fight with someone or bribe your way out or whatever, but where you can set up a place in a way that even if they raid you, the most you will lose will be some property and not your freedom. And if you can make sure that this loss, you know, is paid off in future and past profit, then it's not a big deal.
Yeah,
so
you bring in this inside of one of the sections on Taz. You say in the Second Realm book, you say bribes are a common method to reach this goal. A further tactic promises success. And you list these things: conceal, know, delay, defend, destroy, recover. You want
right.
to give us some examples of this?
Of course. I think that for those people looking at TAZs from the Liberty standpoint or from the agorist standpoint, the big thing is that we actually want to live free and that we want to make our business in a freer way. So we want to sell products that might not be, you know, legal. And the thing you have to keep in mind is that liberty in our time today actually consists of two things, and that is reduce the risk of someone getting after you and reduce the risk of being convicted of anything. So one of the things you can do in a TAZ is to make sure that the risk of being convicted of anything becomes less. So it's a kind of an opaque strategy. And one of the things is this conceal part, which basically means that you have certain controls in place that make it less likely that a sting operation is run against you. For example, you don't have to open doors for everyone, but only enter by membership into certain places of your zone. Okay. Also, when it comes to raids, the big thing is that you want to increase the delay between the enemy arriving and the enemy having control. So you want to know when the police is about to attack. There are several methods for that. The easiest is that you have guards that will, you know, press a little button as soon as the police arrives. Then you want to delay them. You don't want them, you know, to knock through the door within a second and catch you by surprise. But you want to take the surprise element away from them. So, for example, you could have several doors between you and the police so that it takes more time for the police to enter. And while the police is on its way, you would destroy the evidence that is gathered in the place or separated from the owner, so that there's a hard chance to convince anyone of an actual crime. And the thing is, when it happened, and it might happen if you're not a good guy, it might happen that the police comes by. And even if you're a good guy, there's an increased chance of that. And if it happens, you have to be prepared that you recover from it, that you will not stop what you're doing, but that you start over. Because otherwise they will, you know, just beat you down and destroy your property, and that will be their success. But if you do the calculations right, if you have the risk loss profit calculation right, and you recover from it, then you can perpetuate it and basically make it a target that is not worth attacking.
Okay, can you give an example of this risk and the calculation in an example situation where there would be recovery afterwards?
Okay, the risk is mostly in losing property, or especially in losing goods that are less than legal. For example, let's say that you're trafficking
Well,
in marijuana.
in South Africa right now, and many of these places, all you need to be doing is be trading in gold coins that are not Krugerrands. Okay, I mean, so.
Right. Oh, let's take the gold coins in South Africa. So essentially, in every trade, you have a certain margin. You want to make a certain profit, and this profit has to include the loss that you could make, and how much you could lose depends on the value of property or goods that you have in place, and the risk of the police actually coming and taking it from you. So if you have a 10% risk per day that people will come and take your property from you, then you will basically have to factor in those 10% into your profit, so you are able to recover without making a complete loss. So you still have some profit left, so that the work remains profitable, and that you don't run out of capital. So that is basically the calculation you have to make.
It's sort of a self-insurance type thing, yeah.
Well, if you're working on a bigger system, where you have several of those places, not just one of those places, but let's say we have 50 of those places that cooperate with each other. In that scenario, insurance becomes more interesting, because insurance is basically that you divide the losses over many people, so that the individual event doesn't rob them all their capital. And you can only do that if you separate the events from each other. So if you have just one TAZ and it gets raided, then everyone will lose, and your internal insurance will fail. That's it. But if you have 50 TAZs, then that is a whole different thing, because they won't be raided at the same time, so they can essentially recover together.
Okay, interesting. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Sure. Actually, my point is done. That's it.
Oh, yeah. Well, we were going about the example of a recovery. Oh, was that the end of your point? Was that
Yeah,
you have
the end.
considered ahead of time and then.
You have to come out of a raid with enough capital to restart again.
Right.
If you haven't planned for recovery, then they will raid you and just raid you to make you go away and break you down. But if you have enough capital left and the decision to recover immediately, then you can perpetuate the system without end.
Okay, so that pretty much covers the conceal, know, delay, defend, destroy, recover. I
Right,
think
that is
you
about.
talked about some remote controlled sensors and defense mechanisms also in the book.
Yeah, I hinted at a few.
You what?
There are a few things that you can do. I mean, when you look at other people that do that stuff, I mean, there are autonomous zones out there, and hundreds of them actually. Many organized crime syndicates are using autonomous zones. Motorcycle gangs do that, and so on and so on. So the easiest way to get started is actually you have a reinforced door to delay an attacker, and an outside CCTV system so you can see the attacker before he actually breaks down the door. And with that, you have actually the alarm part, the knowing part, and the delaying part covered. And from there on, there's lots of technological stuff you can do, lots of engineering. So you might have a larger area where you're using ground sensors to detect people coming onto the property long before they're approaching your walls. Or you might use things like counter surveillance, where you essentially have an eye on potential attackers before they even decide that you're a target. So, for example, tracking police cars and stuff like that. So
Right.
there's a lot of that stuff you can do, and there's absolutely no end to the engineering tasks you can choose for yourself in such a scenario. So, for example, when it comes to delaying or defending, There have been people thinking about using Korean border guard robots and hooking them up to an anonymous network to basically, you know, fend off attackers. So there's lots of stuff, and you easily slip into less realistic or at least more crazy ideas there.
Right. Okay. Now, you know, since the beginning, we've been talking about these areas, and many times it's been brought up that some of these zones are not necessarily ideal, you know, zones where many people would want to just, you know, pack up and move off and raise their kids there.
Right.
So, or there's issues of that maybe the standard of living is not as such. But a couple of issues on that are that just because these things are like that does not mean that a TAS needs to be these things. It's just that these particular areas are of such of a nature that they have been the forgotten areas or the areas that are left alone because the incentive for the police or some government terrorcrats to pillage or plunder or to control and to meddle into the minor details, it has not been economically viable. The incentive for them has not been as such. Go ahead.
Most of the places that look that way only from the Western perspective. But when you look at favelas, when you look at slums and whatever, people don't move there because it's going to be a worse place to live. But for many of them, it's a better place to live than the place they lived before. So it's actually an increase of standard of living for many of them. So there's a big difference if you're living somewhere in the countryside and not having any food, or moving to a favela where you can actually work outside of farming and have food on the table. So it's actually for many of them, it's an increase of the standard of living.
Right.
And when you look at some of the places that have been favelas for quite some time, you will see housing projects there, people building their own houses and building good houses, actually. Mm-hmm. So they are creating capital. And they're creating things that can be credited, and so on and so on. So it's the image of the favela from the Western perspective might not be ideal.
Yes.
But from the internal the perspective from internal the favela, it's actually a place where living gets better every year. So I wouldn't say that autonomous zones have to be low life zones, and actually they aren't. Right now, they are. People live there because they want to.
Right.
Because living there gives them more than not living there. So
that is
one of the points. The other point is the question is really what you want. So I know, for example, one autonomous zone, which is it's a nightclub bar kind of thing that is frequented by Russian mob. And That is a place that is on the top story of a skyscraper in a European city. Mm. And it's a very, very cool place. I mean, they have lots of good drinks there, lots of nice ladies there. It's very nicely built. And so it's a very good place to party. And it's very clean and very secure. Mm. So that's an autonomous zone as well. So it really depends on what you want to do. And what your resources are. So just because it's an autonomous zone doesn't mean that the standard of living has to be lower.
Right. And in that example, you're talking about a TAS zone that is also not necessarily a place where you live. It can be a place that you go to take care of business or
exactly.
socialize or meet up. And,
exactly.
And yeah, right. Okay. Well,
however, I personally like the combination of not just doing business there, but living there as well, mm-hmm. because it's the living and our neighbors and our social relationships that have been harmed most by the state.
Right.
And relearning how to live free requires us to, you know, live in societies that experiment with it.
Right. So that perspective taken, that is some excellent points. I saw a video series on Nigeria, Lagos, and in there, some of the similar thing was happening. There were people that were setting up these housing apartment type things near these beaches, and the government kept on, they were having the people come in for investment. They're trying to attract all, they're trying to make Lagos this, you know, this London type of a thing for the right. area down there. And so they're going in, they're trying to wipe out these areas that are, that they consider to be an eyesore, okay? And a lot yes. of activity, unregulated activity that's happening. It's a fantastic series. I recommend everyone check it out on, I think it was something like a BBC, and it was, you can find it on YouTube. And in there, the underground black market economy, the things that people were doing, everyone doing business with Joe. And then you'd see these people that were popping up these, they're almost like these storage places like you see in the U.S. from U-Haul, where you go in and you rent a garage, basically, to do storage. They were building these things and people were buying them and moving in there. And an outsider would look at this as, you know, oh my goodness, you know, they're, look at this, like practically a little garage that this guy's getting. But these people were super happy, and they were out there doing all kinds of creative work, hard labor. And even the hard labor was not just, you know, hammering something. They were actually producing goods that were needed for other people that were doing other types of business. So there's all this activity happening, and these people were buying their houses. And they were Absolutely. No longer having to rent and live in other places. And they were just so happy that they were, you know, moving up in this stuff. So, yeah, it does have that perspective. Now back to what my point where I was going with it was that just because many of these places may look like that to a Westerner, they have to realize that one of the reasons why they may – be in that position is because of if they were in some of these locations, if they were had a higher standard of living, if there was much more higher property value, then there would have been more incentive for these people to go ahead and violate these zones and try to integrate them into their taxation, you know, milking them for more taxes and the like. So as we look at these other environments, it's possible for these TASVA environments to grow up and for economic activity to happen and for them to actually thrive. It's just that the more that you thrive, the more that you stick your head up to being, you know, integrated into their – you become more of a target. So becoming less of a target may mean less interfacing with the border – in areas of, let's say, banking, okay? If you're doing alternative currencies, if you're doing right. Digital cash and you're doing some of these other things, you're not necessarily showing yourself to be that much of a target as opposed to some, you know, let's say a collective of Amish communities in Indiana
yep.
Doing business with each other. You know, they may be able to do that and survive on themselves, but then they start doing big business with each other, and instead of settling with goods and services and you know, barter and cash and digital cash or whatever, they all just go out and get these bank accounts and start transferring all their stuff back and forth, and all these massive red flags stand up. And at that point, then these tyrants see, hey, whoa, ho, ho, look at all this that's going over there, a big, fat, juicy target, so they go over to it.
And right. I mean, the whole concept behind Second Realm is that you break down as many links to the world of the states as you can, so that you are not influenced by it, that you are not becoming too much of a target, that you do not incorporate too many risks from other places. So yes, of course. I mean, it's actually it doesn't help too much if you only have a physical autonomous zone. You have to integrate that into the whole you know, chain of transactions that you're doing.
Right. There was a post up on justlive.us on about a I forget the name of it right now. It was a system for self-sufficient system. Let me pull this up here. Oh, a civilization starter kit. And in it has all these instructions for like 10 grand, how you can become this like self-sufficient thing. And Jim Davidson that was on the show yesterday commented, why do these people want, why is their goal, let's see the quote. He says, I'm always curious why villages have to be self-sustaining. I mean, why can't they specialize and engage in trade and commerce? And that's where the magic comes in when people start specializing and engaging in commerce, because otherwise you're looking at possibly just sustenance rather than being able to excel in wealth and prosper and move forward.
Right. However, I think that the ideal is somewhere in the middle. So you have to be able to sustain yourself in times of crisis, for especially when you're an autonomous zone. You have to be able to hold out. You know, when you're under siege, you have to be able to hold out for a few days, or maybe even weeks. But real increase of capital and standard of living comes from, you know, specializing, working together, cooperation, and so on and so on. And the real vision is that one day we might have many of those places cooperating with each other, trading with each other, and building actually something like a secondary network, a secondary parallel society that you know, tries to make a few things better than they're done right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, where can somebody? There's going to be listeners that are listening to this and they're thinking, "Wow, you know, I would love to." Have access or be part of a TAS zone or a online in cyberspace or in physical meat space. And there's a couple of options. One, you can find these locations and try to join up. Many times it's difficult just to jump in because you don't have any references. This is in physical space or in cyberspace. Other times you can, you know, get a reference and get in. And then the other option is for a lot of people out there that really have no contacts at all to any of these existing systems, and they have no idea how they would even begin to start, even if they wanted to try to build up some type of reputation and eventually be part of it. They have the option of starting up their own TAS. So if they have in their own friends, you know, you can – just a couple of suggestions, and then I'll throw this over to you for some ideas that you have. Is if you wanted to start up your own TAS in your local area, you can get together with your own friends and create, you know, instead of, I saw this article the other day that was talking about these coding, midnight coders or something like that, where these guys were, they said, we're not interested in this old cliche of the guys getting together for poker night or for drinking together. We're interested in getting together and just coding on some cool projects or the like. But that same type of a thing, instead of poker night, you can have your own TAS get together where you talk about your things and your business or whatever your interests are. And as part of that, you can say, okay, for the business that we're going to do, we're not going to be sending each other money through PayPal. Okay, we're going to be using gold, silver, physical. We're going to be trading in Loom or Bitcoin or an open transaction, all these new systems that are coming out there. That's how we're going to be doing our stuff. We're not going to be using Gmail. We're going to be using encrypted mail or an encrypted chat, you know, and you start to create your own little TAS. So what are your ideas and suggestions for people that want to either start up their own? Are there templates? Are there places they can go to see how exactly these systems would work, and in physical space, or, you know, what are your ideas?
One of the things that brings a lot of profit is looking for Kowloon Walled City and looking for resilient communities on Google. That's one of the things. The other thing is connecting with a few people that are talking about that, and one of those places is the agora.aniplex.net chat server. When it comes to digital types, it really makes sense to invest some time into researching I2P and Tor and darknets. It's something that is really, starting right now. It's not a big thing yet. Uh-huh. But there's a big project going on in Berlin right now, where there are several thousand square meters to be converted to a TAZ in City Central. So and you can find the guys over the Agora chat system.
Wow, that's fascinating. Do you want to talk about the container thing, or do you think that's for another show? Is that related with Taz?
We should do that on a different show. It's related to TAS, yes. Okay. But we're over time already, I think.
What's that?
We are past our time, so.
Yeah, no. that's another topic that listeners would be fascinated to know about, these portable living units and interchangeable. These units fit into they're portable, they move around, and they can create these dynamic trading TAS zones and living zones.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I guess we're going to cover that in another show. So
yes, sir.
Well, that sums up a lot here. I think we're done. Any closing comments?
That's it. Live free.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Jonathan, for coming on. Been very enjoyable. Everyone, check out the other episode on Hawala and the future episodes we're going to do on Second Realm topics with Jonathan Logan. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Yep. Bye-bye.
Well, that was great. We're going to leave out here with another one. You know who it's by, Crystal Method. You know it's hard. Catch you guys soon.
Time. Dodge this.